This lecture, entitled Assimilation and the Sanhedrin of Napoleon Bonaparte, is dedicated to the memory of Le'ilu Nishmos, Immanuel ben Shoshana, Unosim ben Fardosa, Aleihem HaShalom, of blessed memory. In previous lectures, we discussed the philosophy of Moses Mendelssohn and his circle. Although he was known far and wide within the non-Jewish world for his philosophical works, in the Jewish world, Mendelssohn's most famous work was his translation and commentary to the Torah. His purpose in composing this work was threefold. One was to educate the youth of Germany into what he felt was the correct meaning of the text of the Torah, as well as to acquaint them with the beauty of the Hebrew language. The commentary was based on the classic commentaries such as Rashi, Rashbam, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, and Radak, who was limited specifically to those that kept closest to the pshat, the simple meaning of the text. Mendelssohn also put a special emphasis on the analysis and structure of the language, and thus hoped thereby to create a renaissance of the biblical Hebrew language, a project which he and other members of his circle were dedicated. Originally, the commentary was supposed to have been supplied by Rav Shlomo of Dubna, a noted Talmud Chacham, a Talmudic scholar, who was also a grammarian and a biblical scholar, and the tutor of Mendelssohn's son, Joseph. According to the preface of this work, Mendelssohn had originally composed this translation for the use of his own children. But at the insistence of Rav Dubna, it was made available to the wider public as to acquaint German youth as a whole, not just Mendelssohn's children, what they felt to be the correct translation of the Torah. On page one, here on the first, on section one, we quote from Mendelssohn's preface to his translation regarding the importance of having a correct translation available to the Jewish public. And he starts, why a new translation? In 1545, the great grammarian Rabbi Eliyahu Bucher translated the Pentateuch and the Megillus word for word into the German and had this translation printed at Constance in Switzerland. Actually, this was the second printing. The first edition was actually printed in Venice, Italy. In 1679, he was followed by Rabbi Yoel Witzenhausen and Rabbi Kusiel Blitz, the latter possessing approbations of the most distinguished rabbis of his time. Rabbi Kusiel says in his preface that he had seen the German translation of the Pentateuch printed at Constance and found it so faulty and unfit that he was convinced the translation could not emanate from the celebrated German grammarian. I, the writer of this, have never seen the translation attributed to Rabbi Eliyahu, as it was not to be had in our country. But I have seen that of Rabbi Kusiel and observed that he censures faults from which he himself is not free. Though his intention might have been praiseworthy, and he might perhaps on that account have obtained the approbation of contemporary rabbis, it is certain that the execution of the work is not deserving of praise. For he is quite ignorant of Hebrew and therefore did not understand how to penetrate into the depth of the Hebrew style. What he understood, he rendered into a most corrupt language so that one who has been accustomed to pure language feels quite disgusted with it. I.e., the German that was used in the translation was Judendeutsch, the dialect spoken by Jews in Germany, similar to Yiddish, and not the pure literary German that the intelligentsia, such as Mendelssohn, spoke. We continue. Since then, up to this day, no one has undertaken the task of mending this fault and of rendering our holy writ in correct language, suitable to our age. In other words, that the German used was suitable. The children of Israel, who have a mind for useful studies, sought the knowledge of the Word of God from Christian translations. For in every age, the Christians translated the scriptures according to the variations of language and people, suitable to the wants of the time, and in conformity with the correct use of the language. They did so in euphonious style, now keeping close to the word, then only rendering the sense, now word for word, then by explanatory paraphrase, in order to satisfy the desire of every learner in accordance with the customary language of the age. But this way, which many of our co-religionists have already adopted, leads to manifold mistakes and carries the most dangerous consequences with it. For the Christian translators, who do not recognize the traditions of our sages and do not keep the Masorah, nay more, who do not consider themselves bound by the vowel points and accents as we have them, look upon the sacred volume as quote-unquote as an undefended city, where everyone can go his own way and act according to his own choice. Not only as regards the vowel points and accents, but even as regards the letters and words. They allow themselves optional alterations as they think best, and therefore read in the scriptures not that which they contain, but that which suits them. I will not therefore pronounce censure on these learned authors, for what could bind them to a tradition which has not been handed down by their ancestors, or to a Masorah which has not been laid down by men who appear to them as authorities? But then, they do not consider the Torah from a point of view to observe everything which is written therein. They only treat it as a historical work containing information on the events of past times and representing to them the divine rule and providence in every age. From this point of view, there is no harm in making trifling alterations, adding or omitting a few letters or words, in the same manner as is done with secular authors, where every editor and reviser alters the text according to his judgment. Now, although this may be suitable to Christian authors, it cannot by any means be considered right and proper for us. To us, the Torah is a heritage, not only for remembering the past, but also for attaining a knowledge of the precepts which the Eternal, our God, commanded us to learn, to teach, to observe, and to keep, is our life the preserver of our existence. But in order that we should not be continually in doubt and not have to depend upon the frail reed of speculation, upon the uncertainty of hypotheses, our sages have established the Masorah, thereby erecting a fence around the law and judgment, so that we need not grope in the darkness of conjecture. From this even path, we must not turn either to the right or to the left. We cannot modify our text according to the hypotheses of one or the other grammarian. We must cling to the standard which the authors of the Masorah have established for us. This is a tradition to which we must adhere. By its guidance, we understand the scriptures, search and inquire into them, often according to the simple explanation, often according to the interpretation of our sages, for both are equally true and just, as I shall thereafter show. Again, this is from the preface to Mendelssohn's translation of the Torah, together with his commentary, the Biur, which he entitled Nesivos HaShalom. Now, although Mendelssohn presented the need of publishing this new translation as a means of serving the growing number of youth in the Jewish community who are unable to read the Hebrew text without a translation, but who are already fluent in German and otherwise be forced to avail themselves of a German translation composed by Christians, Mendelssohn actually had another agenda in mind as well. As was made clear from the preface, Mendelssohn's translation was not into Yiddish or Judendeutsch, the language of the ghetto, but the sophisticated German of the university and the salon. In fact, as is evident from a letter to his Christian friend August von Henning, it was Mendelssohn's desire that the Jews of Germany free themselves of the parochial atmosphere of the ghetto and become part of the mainstream German culture. This translation will be a first step in this process. The German language skills that they would gain from his work would now enable them to read any sophisticated German text and thus a whole new world would be open to them. I'd like to quote here, and on page 2, paragraph B. This is a letter that Mendelssohn wrote to the Danish state counselor, August von Henning. After some examination, I found that the remainder of my powers could still suffice to render good service to my children, and perhaps to a considerable part of my nation, if I were to put in their hands a better translation and explanation of the holy books than they had heretofore. This is the first step to culture, something which my nation sadly has kept at such remove that one might almost despair of the possibility of improvement. However, I felt myself obligated to do the little that is in my power and leave the rest to Providence, which for the most part takes longer to carry out its plan than we can see in advance. Now, the more opposition this weak attempt meets, the more necessary it seems to me, and the more zealously I shall seek to carry it through. Mendelssohn's attitude about the direction in which he desired the Jewish community to set about is illustrated by the following. In the year 1778, the Prussian authorities transferred the jurisdiction of contested property rights from the Beisden, the Jewish court of law, to the German civil authorities. The authorities, however, were willing to adjudicate these cases in accordance to traditional Jewish law, halacha, and at the request of Berlin's chief rabbi, Rav Tzvi Hirsch Levin, with whom Mrs. Mendelssohn had a warm relationship, Mendelssohn compiled a German summary of the halachas, the laws governing property rights. Mendelssohn also had a hand in crafting the oath, which was to be administered to Jews by the German civil courts. Here we see Mendelssohn's attitude to the use of Yiddish or Judendeutsch. As is evident, he wanted them to use only proper Hebrew and proper German, but not Yiddish, the language of the ghetto. And here again, on page 2 in paragraph C, we quote from the letter that Mendelssohn wrote to Ferdinand Klein, the assistant counselor of law in Breslau. I should, however, not at all like to see a legal authorization of the Jewish German dialect, Judendeutsch, nor a mixture of Hebrew and German as suggested by Mr. Frankel of Breslau. I am afraid this jargon has contributed more than a little to the uncivilized bearing of the common man. In contrast, it seems to me that the recent usage of pure German among my brethren promises to have a most beneficial effect on them. It would vex me greatly, therefore, if even the law of the land were to promote, so to speak, the abuse of either language. It would be much better if Mr. Frankel tried to put in the entire admonition into pure Hebrew so that it could be read in either pure German or pure Hebrew, or possibly in both, whichever might be best under the circumstances. Anything at all rather than a mishmash of languages. It seems from the following that the dream of Mendelssohn's that someday the Jewish community would no longer be associated with the quote-unquote uncivilized bearing of the common man, and that all of German Jewry would take a recognized place within German society, was a prominent theme in his own household, as we read the words of Mendelssohn's most dedicated disciple, David Friedlander, in his biography of his master, here on the bottom page 2. In Mendelssohn's home, educational and cultural institutions were the outstanding topic of conversation. Improvement of instruction and recommendation of the German mother tongue were Mendelssohn's favorite themes. Now, in order to solicit subscriptions for his work on the Torah, Mendelssohn issued a prospectus which he called Alim Letrufa, Healing Leaves, in 1778, which strongly seems to indicate that it was truly created to heal the cultural ills of Jewry of his time. The first volume, Genesis, Bracius, was published in 1780. Mendelssohn supplied the translation as well as the introduction and the commentary to Parshas Bereishis, the first Sedra section, to set the tone for the remainder of the work. Rav Shlomo Dubna supplied the commentary to the rest of Bereishis. Right before Sefer Shmos, the book of Exodus, was about to be presented to the publisher, Rav Shlomo Dubna mysteriously left Berlin, leaving Mendelssohn with only some of his notes and the task of completing the work for himself. Although Mendelssohn personally wrote the commentary to Sefer Shmos, he had Naftoli Tzvi Wiesel of Veseli, whom we quoted in the last lecture, a noted and respected Hebraic scholar, whose strength was linguistics and poetry, to write the commentary to Vayikra, Leviticus. The commentary to Bamidbar was supplied by an associate of Aaron Yaroslav. The commentary to the first 22 chapters of Devarim, Deuteronomy, was made by Hertz Homburg, the tutor for Mendelssohn's children after Dubna. The commentary was completed by Mendelssohn, who also created the translation for the entire Torah. The initial printing of Alim Letrufa, this prospectus, was greeted with a mixed response. Although this work was praised by the chief rabbi of Berlin, Rav Zvi Hirsch Levin, and the entire Beis Din of Berlin, it was censured by some of Greater Germany's most prestigious rabbonim, the famous Rabbi Cheska Landau of Prague, Noyde B'Yehuda, Rabbi Pinchas Horvitz of Frankfurt, one of the great Talmudists of the time, and the author of the Haflah Masechta on Tractate Ksubas, and Sefer HaMikna Machna, on Masechta Kedushin. Rabbi Fol HaKoyen, this is of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsburg, Mitzvi Hirsch Jan of Posen. They feared that this translation would be a first step to wean German youth away from tradition and to assimilate them into German culture. In hindsight, they were unfortunately vindicated by history. If we are to believe the story which is printed in Sori Meah, a collection of captivating stories by Rav Yehuda Lev Maimon, we will have a further insight as to why Harava Goyen or Rafola Cohen, the chief rabbi of Hamburg, Altona Wandsbek, was so opposed to Mendelssohn's translation. And here we have on page 3. Before the community of Hamburg decided to appoint Rav Rafola Cohen as the chief rabbi of the joint communities of Altona, Hamburg, and Wandsbek, it first wanted him to obtain approbation from Moses Mendelssohn of Berlin. When Harav's, the Rafol HaKoyen, came into Mendelssohn's house, he found him reading from a Tanakh, a Hebrew Bible, without a head covering. The rabbi was extremely angry at him and didn't want to receive a letter of approbation from a person who he deemed to be a heretic. Mendelssohn, however, wrote to the community of Hamburg that even though he didn't have the opportunity to become thoroughly acquainted with Rafol, literally to test the smell of the wine of his container, he nonetheless approves of his being appointed as the chief rabbi of the three communities, for he's a man of integrity and will not compromise his principles and give particular favor to anyone, even when it runs counter to his own best interests. As he protests vigorously and called Mendelssohn a heretic, and wouldn't accept a letter of approbation from him because he had found him studying Tanakh, Hebrew Bible, without a head covering. It's interesting to note that Rav Rafol HaKoyen's opposition, you know, to Mendelssohn's translation, even made the newspapers in Hamburg. As we read here on page 3, this is taken from the Hamburger Correspondent on July 17, 1779, from Altona. The provincial chief rabbi here has proclaimed a ban on anyone who will read the translation of the books of Moses composed by Mr. Moses Mendelssohn of Berlin. As a result of Rav Rafol HaKoyen's fierce opposition, Mendelssohn requested of his friend, the Danish state councillor August von Henning, to intervene on his behalf and arrange that the Danish king and several Danish high officials subscribe to Mendelssohn's translation. Since Hamburg at the time was under Danish rule, Ruffel had but little choice but to tone down his opposition. Now, after completing his commentary to Bereishis, Genesis, Rav Shlomo Dubna abruptly left Berlin and forsook the project. This is how Mendelssohn described Shlomo Dubna's abandonment of the project here. On page 3, says paragraph C, Rav Shlomo Dubna began to print his introduction to his commentary to Exodus, which would appear at the beginning of the book, but it wasn't completed as another spirit came over him. I don't know what happened to him as he forsook me and went back to his native country. But this is, however, how Rav Shlomo Dubna himself described what happened. Here, this is on top of page 4. Harav HaGoyim Rav Toli Hertz, says, Chief Rabbi of Dubna, passed through Berlin and rebuked me by applying to me the verse, because you joined together with Achaziah, this is the prophet is telling Yehoshaphat, who had created a union of sorts. Yehoshaphat was the king of Yehuda, the southern kingdom, and he had a compact, an agreement together with the northern kingdom Yisrael. God will destroy your works. And he says, because I was participating with those who, according to the communications he received from the Rabbon of Prague and Hamburg, are people whose sole thoughts are to uproot the oral law. He continues, I then removed myself from Berlin, and I am no longer together with them in their project. And he continues on, it is true that some of the people who became involved in this work are people who are suspect of having totally removed from themselves the yoke of Torah. Regarding such people, the words of the following verse can truly and rightfully, says, be applied. Remove yourselves, I beg you, from the tents of those wicked men, and touch nothing of theirs, lest you be consumed in all of their sins. This is referring to Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu's directive to the people to remove themselves from the tents of Korach and his followers. Now, this was a letter sent already some years later, in 1789, by Rav Shlomo Dubna for Wolf Heidenheim, who was a noted scholar in Germany and a publisher. At a later date, Rav Shlomo Dubna completed his commentary to the entire Chumash, 5 books of Moses, which received the approbation of the leading rabbis of Europe. For some reason, though, it was not published. The following is taken from the approbation of Rav Yecheskel Landau to Rav Dubna's commentary. And he writes, when Rav Shlomo of Dubna was about to print his work in the Holy Community of Berlin, he sent me a letter and asked me to give him an approbation. I didn't reply to his request, because the work was an amalgam of sacred and profane, for it attached to the Torah an elucidation in a foreign tongue, which the author referred to as being merely a Targum Ashkenazi, a Germanic translation. We are fearful that this translation will be a stumbling block for Jewish youth, will cause a cessation of Torah studies. That is the reason I refrained from giving my approbation. Afterwards, however, they disbanded, and the scholar of Shlomo of Dubna left before completing his commentary to the last 3 books of the Torah. At present, there are many upright individuals who desire that he print his commentary, which is free from impurities and wholly sacred, as it is given at Sinai with great precision, free from any errors, which he composed on all of the 5 books of the Torah, together with his work Tikkun Sofrim, which he composed on all of the sections of the Torah, together with Targum Unkelis and Rashi's commentary. In 1782, Rav Toli Hirtz Veseli published his work on the Reformation of Jewish Education, titled Divri Sholem Ve'emes, Words of Peace and Truth, which we covered in the previous lecture. It received widespread condemnation. What is interesting to note is the connection Rav Yecheskel Landau, the chief rabbi of Prague, made between the educational philosophy of Vasily Wiesel and Mendelssohn in his translation, as we read here on paragraph D, on the bottom, page 4. I have seen, however, it continues, Vasily's quote of Moses Mendelssohn of Dessau, and now I realize that all who judged him harshly were correct. Now, despite fierce rabbinic opposition, Mendelssohn was extremely successful. Within a few decades, Yiddish had died out for the most part in Germany, apart from isolated phrases and expressions. With it came the loss of a common language between Eastern European Jewry and German Jewry, the secularization of German Jewry, and their eventual spiritual decline. At the beginning of this process, Rav Landau was already bemoaning the declining state of German Jewry. And the quote now, this is taken from his landmark work, the Tzalach, the Tzil Nefesh Chaya, from his commentary to Masechta Brachos. And he writes, Rashi explains the phrase, this is the advice that Rebbe Eliezer gave to his students, keep your children away from Higoyim. And what does the word Higoyim mean? He explains as follows. Don't accustom them excessively to the study of Scripture because the power to draw them away. And the Vichesco Lando comments, in my humble opinion, it seems that this is because Scripture is also the subject of study by heretics who study it for its language just as they would study other languages. And if you only concentrate on your children's educational field of Scripture, you may well take for him a teacher who is from their circles. For they also know how to teach Scripture, which will lead him to be drawn towards their perverted beliefs. This is most certainly the case in our own generation, in which the German translation of Scripture, he's referring to the Scripture of Mendelssohn, has been widely distributed and has drawn them to read the works of Gentiles in German in order to enable them to gain expertise in their language. And you could read the rest. One of the great enigmas that historians struggle with is how Moses Mendelssohn, who personally was careful to observe the entire Torah, fathered a movement, the Haskalah, a Jewish secular enlightenment, whose followers soon after his death abandoned the original beliefs and practices of their founder. Not only that, but of his 6 children, 4 eventually converted to Christianity. Mendelssohn's daughter Brendel, or Dorothy, after 15 years of marriage with a Jewish banker, Simon Veit, ran off with a Christian man of letters, Friedrich von Schlegel. She converted first to Protestantism and then to Catholicism. Mendelssohn's daughter, Henrietta, a brilliant woman in the mold of her father, also eventually converted to Catholicism. Moses Mendelssohn's son, Nathan, and his wife, as well as Mendelssohn's son, Abraham, together with his wife and children, converted to Lutheranism. One of Abraham's children was the famous composer and musician, Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdy. In addition, of Moses Mendelssohn's 9 grandchildren, only one, Alexander Mendelssohn, remained a Jew. For many students of history, it comes as a real surprise, especially in light of the fact that his family members all took pride in the fact that they were descended from the famed Moses Mendelssohn, and his grandchildren, who are already converted, were involved in preserving his writings and legacy. It would seem, as we pointed out in previous lectures, that 2 streams of thought resided within Mendelssohn concurrently. One was a traditional stream of thought with which he was brought up as the brilliant yeshiva bocher, who was a close disciple of Rav David Frankel, the author of the Sefer Korban Eda and the Talmud Yerushalmi, whom he followed as a young man of 14 from his native Dessau to Berlin. Although it seems that in his adult years he spent relatively little time studying the Talmud, it is interesting to note that Professor Jacob Katz, in his work Out of the Ghetto, on page 143, wrote that in the year 1761, when Mendelssohn came to Hamburg to see his future wife, Mendelssohn met with the chief rabbi, Harava Goyim Rav Yonasan Eibeshitz, who was so impressed with Mendelssohn that he wrote a letter of recommendation, a diploma of sorts, attesting to his erudition of Talmudic literature. According to Katz, Rav Eibeshitz would have given Mendelssohn smicha, rabbinic ordination, if not for the fact that Mendelssohn was still a bachur unmarried at the time. It is no wonder then that Mendelssohn was insistent the entire Torah, both the written and oral, must be maintained without compromise. The other stream that flowed within him was the Enlightenment philosophy that Mendelssohn so treasured, especially that of the German Enlightenment philosopher Christian Wolff. Mendelssohn was a man well respected within Enlightenment circles and, in a sense, was more comfortable in the company of non-Jewish thinkers than with his own traditional community. In fact, it was this part of his life that he embraced with the greatest enthusiasm. One interesting story that perhaps gives us a peek into the dual streams of his life is a well-known story that was retold by Rav Yosef Wohlgemuth, a lecturer at the Orthodox Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, in a 1929 article in the publication Yeshurun. I quote, "A non-Jew came to visit Mendelssohn on Erev Shabbos, the Sabbath Eve. After they had conversed for a while, Mendelssohn excused himself and retired to the next room to daven, to pray. When he returned, his wife appeared and lit the candles, and then Mendelssohn continued the conversation." On the one hand, the story tells about Mendelssohn's observance of halacha. He davened mincha. His wife lit the candles. But on the other hand, it reveals another side of him. This other side became even evident after his death, as eventually his personal papers and correspondence were published. For example, here on page 5, here in section 3, I quote from a communication from Mendelssohn to Hertz Homburg. "I have no friend among our nation around me who will really get involved with me in speculative matters." Well, there's no one to speak philosophy. "We can understand, therefore, his willingness to forgo tefillah b'tzibur, praying with a minyan, in order to be engaged in the love of his life, philosophical speculation. In the following two letters, we see yet another side of him." The first was a letter to Hofra, this is Michalis, this is Johann David, this is Michalis, of Göttingen. "I am sure that you will treat the Psalms as poetry and not pay attention to the prophetic and mystical elements which Christians as well as Jewish interpreters have found in them, only because they search for these elements, having searched for these elements only because they were neither philosophers nor literary critics." And here in the next citation here, this is a letter to John Johann Zimmermann, the court physician in Hanover. He writes, "As regards a great many of the Psalms, I must admit that I simply do not understand them. The ones I find easiest to understand include many which I must class as very mediocre pieces of poetry, incoherent verses, repetition of the same idea, ad nauseum, and abrupt transitions and modulations which no amount of inspiration could justify." Continues on, "The character of some difficult psalms is such that you can read into them whatever you like, presumably because we do not know the events that inspire their composition, because the author, the time, and the circumstances of their origin are not known, or because some of the passages in the text have been corrupted, etc. I could cite for you two psalms which commentators of both nations interpret as messianic prophecies. I, for my part, have subjected them to more thorough study and have arrived at the conclusion that the one is a satire and avarice, and the other, this is Psalm 110, is a piece of flattery composed by a court poet in honor of King David when the king's army laid his siege in Rabbah. So much for that." Such musings are typical of non-Jewish biblical critics of that period and beyond. that these sentiments were also voiced by Mendelssohn, an Orthodox Jew who had studied in yeshiva, is somewhat troubling and gives great credence to Mendelssohn's critics. Mendelssohn's personal philosophy that Judaism doesn't dictate true beliefs, those beliefs, you know, which can be universally attained without revelation, and only dictates action, in other words, orthoprax, correct practice, versus orthodox, correct belief or doctrine, is shockingly evident in the following quote from his collected writings. This is on page 6, in paragraph D. Notwithstanding his speculative doctrine, Spinoza could have remained an Orthodox Jew if he had not removed himself from the law. In other words, had he practiced, whatever he believed, he would be considered an Orthodox Jew. Now, although Mendelssohn himself was opposed to the pantheistic belief system of Spinoza, who denied nearly all of the beliefs that Jews have always deemed sacred, the fact that Mendelssohn felt that Spinoza, if he observed halacha, could be considered to be an Orthodox Jew within the fold, is another indication of Mendelssohn's own approach to Judaism, as well as his philosophical tolerance. This is further indicated, that tolerance, by the following letter to Caspar Levater, a Swiss theologian. And this is in paragraph EM, page 6. In matters of fundamental religious or ethical conviction, I'm a dogmatist. That is to say, I've made my decision and firmly stand on the ground where I believe I can find the greatest measure of truth. When it comes to judging my neighbor, I'm a skeptic. This is to say, I have my doubts, for I greatly distrust my ability to convince any man of the truth of my own convictions, the more so since I grant him the same right I claim for myself, the right of free religious choice. Now the study of Torah, especially Gemara in depth, has always been the principal anchor of the Jewish community, as we pointed out in previous lectures. The Haskalah, the secular enlightenment, wanted to change the focus of Judaism from the Talmud to the Bible and Hebrew language. The roots of this movement can also be traced to Mendelssohn and his circle. The following correspondence between Mendelssohn and Hertz Homburg, the one-time tutor of Mendelssohn's son Joseph, is quite revealing, especially the manner in which Mendelssohn accepted the fact that his son no longer desired to study Torah. In paragraph F. My son Joseph has all but given up his Hebrew studies. Immediately following your tutelage, he unfortunately fell into the hands of a scholar who proved to be a hollow bald pilpul. You know, a dialectician. And as much as Joseph loves intellectual acuity and scholarly disputation, he lacks a sense for real pilpul. As you know, it takes a very special kind of instruction to develop a taste for this sort of mental exercise. And then both you and I underwent this training. You'll recall that we agreed that Joseph's mind should rather remain a little duller than be sharpened in so sterile a manner. Well, the distaste he felt for his teacher's instructions made him reject all Hebrew studies. He's, however, making good progress in the natural sciences. Right now, it might thereby be best to let him study wherever he wants or feels inclined to. This would, to say the least, not be detrimental to him if he were to indeed to become a businessman. Or he could, if need be, do what his father had to do, muddle through now as a scholar, now as a businessman, though this carries with the danger that one ends up not being really either. And I just, it goes without saying, imagine this as a Jewish mother and her son doesn't want to learn Torah anymore. She'd tear out her hair. She'd be crying. She'd be running to this Rebbe, that Rebbe. Didn't bother Mendelssohn that much. Now, regarding the tolerance and love that Mendelssohn showed for students of philosophy, even those who did not share his religious commitment, I quote now from the autobiography of Solomon Maimon, Maimon was an eccentric prodigy who, after a thorough Talmudic education, abandoned his wife and children and traveled to Berlin to pursue philosophical studies. Here he describes his first meeting with Mendelssohn. He writes, "I also compare these new metaphysical doctrines of the German Enlightenment philosopher Christian Wolff with those of Maimonides, or rather of Aristotle, which are already known to me, and I could not reconcile them. I therefore resolved to set these doubts forth in Hebrew to send what I wrote to Herr Mendelssohn, of whom I had already heard so much. When he received my communication, he was not a little astonished at it. He replied at once that my doubts were in fact well-founded, that I should nevertheless not allow them to discourage me, but continue to study with the zeal with which I had begun. Thus encouraged, I wrote a Hebrew dissertation in which I questioned the foundations of revealed as well as of natural theology. All the 13 articles of faith laid down by Maimonides, I attacked with philosophical arguments, with the exception of one, namely that on reward and punishment, to which I conceded philosophical relevance as a necessary consequence of free will. I sent this dissertation to Mendelssohn, who was quite amazed that a Polish Jew, scarcely got as far as seeing Wolff's metaphysics, was so soon able to penetrate into their depths to the point of questioning their conclusions by means of a correct ontology. He invited me to call and accepted his invitation. But I was shy, and the manners and customs of the Berliners were strange to me, and it was with trepidation and embarrassment I ventured to enter a fashionable house. When I opened Mendelssohn's door and saw him and the other gentlefolk there, as well as the beautiful rooms and elegant furniture, I shrank back, closed the door, and had mind not to go in. But Mendelssohn had noticed me. He came out and spoke to me very kindly, led me to his room, placed himself beside me at the window, and paid me many compliments about my writing. He assured me that if I persisted, I should in a short time make great progress in metaphysics, and he promised to resolve my doubts. Not satisfied with this, the worthy man looked after my maintenance also, recommended me to the most eminent, enlightened, and wealthy Jews of Berlin, who made provisions for my board and other wants. I was given the freedom of their tables, and their libraries were open to my use." Within the lifetime of Mendelssohn, the beginnings of the subsequent changes took root. Some of his circle, like David Friedlander and Solomon Maimon, would eventually abandon the observance of Judaism, but did not formally undergo conversion. The truth is, however, that both of them made an attempt of undergoing a nominal conversion in order to become accepted within Christian society. Their requests were both refused, however, as they wanted to accept Christianity without accepting the key belief in Christianity, the centrality of Yeshu and his teachings. Other philosophers of the circle, like Dr. Marcus Hertz, who together with his wife Henrietta conducted a salon in their home where non-Jewish as well as Jewish thinkers could gather and converse and debate philosophical issues, made no attempt at conversion. His wife Henrietta, however, subsequent to the death of her husband in 1803 and her Orthodox mother in 1817, underwent conversion, became a passionate Protestant. As we stated before, two of Mendelssohn's own sons and two of his daughters underwent conversion. But this was long after their father's death. Now, it seems that real statistics are lacking as to the amount or percentage of individuals or families that defected from the Jewish community and became Christians. The historian Heinrich Schnee reported that during the period between the last decades of the 18th century and the first decade of the 19th, a full two-thirds of the descendants of the court Jews became baptized. Because of their secular education, which prepared them to do business and maintain social contact with the outside world, coupled with a prevalent negative attitude against the rabbinic establishment, and the now inconvenient, strict life that traditional Judaism demanded, they, unlike their ancestors, the court Jews, defected en masse from the Jewish community. According to Professor Katz in his work Out of the Ghetto, this is on page 121, as early as 1790, this is only 4 years after Mendelssohn's death, the communal leader of Berlin complained that many who had inherited a fortune from their parents, which is probably referring to the children of the court Jews, who could have materially assisted the community, had gone over to Christianity. Regarding the level of observance of such Jews before they converted, in a letter written in the year 1783 by the famous artist Daniel Nicholas Chadoyevsky, he described the situation of Berlin Jewry to the Countess of Solms-Laubach. Quote, "It seems that where you live, the Jews are still Orthodox. Here, with the exception of the lower classes, they are so by no means. They buy and sell on Saturdays, eat all forbidden foods, keep no fast days, etc." Now, although his description of Berlin Jewry may be somewhat of an exaggeration, it would be no surprise, however, that in the atmosphere in the years following Mendelssohn's death, such Jews would entirely sever their connection to the Jewish community. Some indication of this phenomenon of mass conversion is evident from the writings of the influential Protestant theologian Friedrich Daniel, this is Ernst Schleiermacher, who wrote in 1799 regarding the difference between those Jews who converted some 20 or 30 years before and those who had converted only recently. Quote, "True, there were from time to time some proselytes, but they were, except for lovers whom I exempt," I mean they converted due to intermarriage, "only bad creatures of whom the Jewish communities were only too glad to be rid, those who were ruined or brought to despair." Everything is different now. There are different kind of people altogether who are preoccupied with the idea of turning Christian. Educated, well-to-do persons, well-versed in all worldly things, who wish to acquire rights and be accepted as citizens. End quote. He also wrote that he was fearful that the influx of so many Jews was a result in the Judaization of Christianity, chas v'shalom. In his eyes, a frightful prospect. In a letter written by David Friedlander to the Russian Chancellor Karl August Fürst von Hardenberg, he enumerates the cases of baptism that occurred in Berlin during the preceding 5 to 8 years. There's a 3-year period between 1803 to 1806. He collected 50 cases, all designated by name, some of them single, others parents with children, this out of a community of 405 established families. So this is a 3-year period. I mean, he wrote this up, you know, some years later, like he wrote this in 1811, but he went through the records between 1803 and 1806. Friedlander estimated this proportion was the same in the provincial cities, especially Breslau and Königsberg. It seems, though, that later on, once Jews in Germany were accepted as citizens towards the end of the Napoleonic era, much of this conversion came to an end, as the motivation to convert, obtaining rights and citizenship, were now available without having to cut family ties and make an insincere declaration of belief. Within the Jewish community, those of Mendelssohn's circle who followed in their master's footsteps of not abandoning Judaism or the Jewish community also followed his lead in trying to influence the Jewish community to change their orientation from being culturally isolated and focusing on Talmudic studies to becoming more cosmopolitan and focusing on biblical and Hebraic studies. To that end, already in Mendelssohn's lifetime, an intellectual society was created in Königsberg, which is today Kaliningrad, entitled Dorshei Sfas Ever, Friends of the Hebrew Language, by young admirers of Mendelssohn, and produced the first modern Jewish journal entitled HaMa'asef, The Collector. The so-called Ma'asfim, editors and contributors of this journal, at the urging of Mendelssohn's colleague Naftali Herzwiesel Veseli, initially did not want to antagonize the rabbinic establishment. They merely issued a journal that concentrated on the beauty of the Hebrew language, poetry, biblical exegesis, interpretation based upon the pshat, the simple meaning of the text, rather than on the midrashic explanation. In effect, the publishers wanted to create a revolution in Jewish education, an education that focused upon the Hebrew language and the simple meaning of the biblical text, and not on the Talmud and its related literature. Hamasov also dedicated much space to biographical studies of men who, like Mendelssohn, embodied the ideal of combining general education with Hebrew scholarship, i.e., leading figures such as Mendelssohn, Rambam, Rav Yosef del Medigo, this is Rav Menashe ben Yisrael. It was also a vehicle to create the beginnings of a modern Hebrew literature, using satire as a means of criticizing traditional Jewish life. Yitzhak Eichel, this is a disciple of Mendelssohn. He was a disciple as well as Immanuel Kant, who was a co-editor and a major contributor to the Maasef for its first 6 years, composed his Igros Meshulam, which he published in the Hamasek, a satire of Jewish life in Germany through the eyes of a Jewish traveler from Aleppo, Syria. You know, then through the eyes of this is strange and that's strange. Now, although at its onset Hamasek was relatively conservative, in 1787 the publication moved to Berlin, and it took upon itself a more radical complexion. Instead of the society being called Dorshe Sfas Ever, says the Friends of the Hebrew Language, they now called themselves the Gesellschaft zu Beförderung des Guten und Edlen, Society for the Propagation of Goodness and the Noble. The emphasis was now shifted from the Hebrew language to the physical and political world, and the editors and writers came out more directly and demanded that the rabbis and leaders of Israel change the focus of the Jewish community and its education to be along the lines were suggested by Veseli and Mendelssohn. The society temporarily stopped publishing Amasef in 1790, and after 4 years, in 1794, was republished in Breslau under an even more radical editorship. But only lasted some 3 years, as those German Jews who were still interested in reading Hebrew did not share Hamasov's radical orientation. Now, this is how Solomon Maimon describes the work of the Maasvim here on page 7, paragraph H. A number of young Jews from all parts of Germany had united during Mendelssohn's lifetime to form a society under the designation Society for Research unto the Hebrew Language. They correctly observed that the evil condition of our people, morally as well as politically, has its source in their religious prejudices, in their want of a rational exposition of holy scriptures, and the arbitrary exposition to which the rabbis are led by their ignorance of the Hebrew language. At least this is his opinion. Accordingly, the object of their society was to remove these deficiencies, to study the Hebrew language and its sources, and by that means to introduce a rational exegesis. For this purpose, they resolved to publish a monthly periodical in Hebrew under the title Hamasef, the Collector, which is to present expositions of difficult passages in Scripture, Hebrew poems, prose, essays, translations from useful works, and the like. And again, we just have in brackets the periodical period from 1783 until 1797, first in Königsberg, then in Berlin, and last in Breslau.
Why did they put so much effort into something that obviously they rejected?
You're asking about why they put so much effort
into something they're obviously rejected.
What do you mean?
They don't take the Talmud, they don't understand.
At that time, they basically... Many of them still practice Judaism and were still connected to the Jewish community and felt that the stress was wrong and they could still have a connection spiritually to Judaism, by rejecting the Talmud, for all practical reasons. But this is how they wanted to change it. This is their vehicle of changing the Jewish community. They really wanted basically to change the community. In 1809, Hamasif, because we said that it was last until 1797. In 1809, Hamasif was republished under new editorship and reinstates a original policy of promoting the Hebrew language and biblical exegesis. By this time, however, the original readership had already become assimilated and had very little interest in such publications. Its new readership came from areas such as Prague, Posen, Glogau, who were only now breaking out of the ghetto and who were still able to read a Hebrew language periodical and yet were amenable to the ideology of the Haskalah. Because they were so successful that the original readers left. This period of German Haskalah, the refocusing of Jewish life towards biblical and Hebraic scholarship, was relatively short-lived, however, as many of those who initially embraced it went even further and became totally assimilated or gave their children such little Hebrew education that the next generation had little interest in Haskalah, specific Jewish enlightenment, but rather in general enlightenment. It took another half century before the Haskalah would again captivate the minds of Jews, but this time it took place in Russia and Poland. That story will be covered in Mirza Hashem. This is in future lectures. Just to conclude the section, I would like to quote from Shamshon Fold Hirsch's 19 Letters of Ben Uziel, wherein he describes Moses Mendelssohn's influence upon future generations of German Jews. I'm not going to quote it in its entirety, but I'll just start quote from the beginning, and you can read the rest. When the external yoke began to grow lighter and the spirit felt freer, there arose again a brilliant personality who inspired great respect. This is Moses Mendelssohn, who, by his commanding influence, has led to the later development up to this very day. This commanding individual, who had not drawn his mental development from the wellsprings of Judaism, was great chiefly in philosophical disciplines, in metaphysics and aesthetics. He studied the Bible only from philological and aesthetic point of view. He did not build up Judaism as a science from within itself, but merely defended it against political stupidity and pietistic Christian insinuations. Personally observant Jew, Mendelssohn showed the world and his brethren that it was possible to be a strictly religious Jew and yet to shine forth as a German Plato. The words "and yet" were decisive. His followers contented themselves with developing the study of the Bible in the philological aesthetic sense, with studying the Mora, the Mora Nevuchim, the Guide to the Perplexed of Rambam, and yet pursuing and spreading the humanities. But Judaism, Bible, and Talmud were neglected. Even the most zealous study of the Bible was of no avail for the proper understanding of Judaism, because it was not treated as the authoritative source of doctrine and instruction, but only as a beautiful poetic storehouse in which to draw rich supplies for the imagination. With the Talmud thus neglected and practical Judaism thus completely uncomprehended, it was but natural that the formal symbolizing and abstract interpretation of Judaism, which had for a time been in the background, again became prevalent and was carried to an extreme which threatened to destroy all of Judaism. And they continued, people should have asked themselves, is Moses the son of Maimon or Moses the son of Mendel really identical with Moses the son of Amram? Okay, you can read and read it. In the midst of all of this, France was undergoing its own radical changes. In a previous lecture, we traced the events that led up to the granting the Jews of France, both Sephardic and Ashkenazic, the rights of citizenship on September 28, 1791. 2 days later, on September 30th of that year, the National Assembly, after completing a new constitution for France, was dissolved. The euphoria surrounding those events was short-lived, for soon after, France was gripped by what is known today as the Reign of Terror. Fearing that fleeing French noblemen had convinced the kings of Austria and Prussia that they too would face the dangers of armed revolution if they wouldn't actively support the cause of a counter-revolution, the revolutionary French government took the initiative and fearing they would be attacked you know, by Austria and Prussia. Then April 1792 declared war against Austria and Prussia. This led, of course, to an invasion by the Austrians and Prussians. Initially, the French forces were overwhelmed with the enemy poised at the gates of Paris. On September 20th, the French repelled the Prussians, and on November 6th, they defeated the Austrians and soon overran the Austrian Netherlands, today's Belgium. In the middle of all of this, fearing a counter-revolution, the French came together and really formed a new assembly. And in this new assembly, they did away with the monarchy. They arrested Louis XVI and eventually had him beheaded. In the process, this revolutionary government felt that their enemy was not only the monarchy, it was the church. They wanted to do away with the church. What happened was the anti-Christian focus of the revolutionaries, they closed the churches. And in fact, the Jews who had worked so hard for citizenship, says they closed down the shuls as well. And in a sense, is that the Jews really felt the brunt. Now they had worked so hard for equality, now really felt the brunt of this revolution. Because consequently, after this new assembly, this revolutionary assembly, who had done away with the monarchy, began to do away with Judaism as well. The practice of Judaism was outlawed, including Shabbos and Bris Milah, circumcision. The central synagogue of Metz was turned into a barn, with its grounds becoming an animal pasture. To give you a sense of the popular revolutionary and anti-Semitic sentiments of that time, as well as the state of Ashkenazic French Jewry, I would like to read to you from a directive made by the district procurator of Lorraine on November 21st of 1793. Quote, "It is the inhumane law of these people that the newborn male infant is to be bloodily operated upon, as if nature herself were imperfect. They wear long beards with ostentation, mimicking the patriarchs whose virtues they themselves have failed to inherit. They employ a language of which they are ignorant and which has long fallen into disuse. In consequence, I do require of the Provisional Commission that it forbid them such practices and arrange for an auto de fe, this is to truth, and i.e. burning, of all Hebrew books and of the Talmud most especially, the author of which was so mischievous as to permit them to make usurious loans to men who are not of their faith." End quote. Now, eventually, this reign of terror, which really occurred when the revolutionary government felt itself besieged from all sides and created a dictatorship. There was a committee of public safety, was headed by Maximilian Robespierre. He was given the rights of dictator. And for a period of almost a year, he rid himself of some 11,000 of his enemies. They were guillotined. At the end of this reign of terror, because they were attacked from all sides by this first coalition, he made the first all conscription army instead of a volunteer army, and they were able to defeat their enemy. It was quiet on the home front, and the people were disgusted with his reign of terror, arrested Robespierre and had him guillotined. But now, even after the reign of the end of the reign of terror and execution of Robespierre, the internal situation within France was still highly volatile. With the radicals, the remaining members of the Jacobin party, that was the party of Robespierre, those that led the reign of terror, now themselves becoming the target of mass execution. In addition, France suffered from food shortages and unemployment. Seeing all of this as an opportunity to return to power, a royalist emigre force transported by British ships landed in France in July of 1795, only to be met, however, by an overwhelming Republican force. It was now that they had done away with the monarchy, they called themselves a republic. The royalists were totally annihilated, and in the flush of this victory, the National Convention decided to create a new but moderate constitution, modeled after the one ratified in 1791, with a director to five directors in place of the former king. This new constitution was met, however, with resistance by many of the populace, especially the poor. Among other objections, the general populace was opposed to the new constitution as it restricted the right to vote only to the wealthy or middle-class citizens, the bourgeoisie. The poor, who didn't pay taxes or own property, were now excluded. This was probably done to ensure that the most radical elements of the populace, who were predominantly poor, would never again try to take hold of the government as they had done in the most recent past. All of this dissent finally came to a head in October of 1795 as a public revolt broke out. Paul Barras, a member of the newly elected directorate, who had been granted full military powers, appointed a young officer, a Corsican by the name of Napoleon Bonaparte, to suppress the revolt. And together with another officer, this Joachim Murat, he skillfully used his military and infantry to rout the rebels. Within 4 months, the opposition was totally destroyed. As a result, in March of 1796, Bonaparte was rewarded by the directorate and appointed as commander of the Army of the Interior, the nation's southern army. It was in this position that Bonaparte's brilliance as a military commander became evident to all, as Bonaparte soon began a series of operations to divide and defeat the Austrian and Sardinian armies in Italy. First, he defeated the Sardinians in April 21st. This is in 1796, in Mondavi, forcing them to conclude a separate peace by which Savoy and Nice were ceded to France. Then in a series of brilliant maneuvers and battles, he won Lombardy, northern Italy from the Austrians. Mantua, the last Lombard stronghold, fell in February of 1797. After a prolonged siege, in the process, Bonaparte had defeated four attempts to relieve the siege. As he crossed the Alps to advance on Vienna, the Austrians sued for an armistice, which was concluded in April of 1797. Bonaparte then personally negotiated the Treaty of Campo Formio. This is on October 17th of 1797, ending the War of the First Coalition. Wherever Napoleon went, he made sure to break down the ghetto gates where the Jews were forced to live. In city after city, Ancona, Rome, Padua, the ghettos were torn down and the Jews emancipated. Now, time doesn't allow for a thorough treatment of Napoleon's career. Suffice it to say, as a result of his stunning victories and growing popularity, especially amongst his troops who idolized him, upon returning to France in October 1799, and finally again in the midst of a turmoil and general dissatisfaction with the government, he decided the only way to salvage the situation was for him himself to seize power and to create a dictatorship. On November 9, 1799, Napoleon deposed the directory and formed a new government. It was called the Consulate, as it consists of three consuls, Napoleon being named the first consul, and the actual power behind the consulate. Finally, after so many years of corruption and volatility, order and regularity was restored to every branch of the government. Napoleon centralized the local governments, appointing the prefects and mayors and their councils. The court system worked that had worked well during the Republic was now made even more efficient. He pacified the rebellious regions of France and reconciled the royalists. He actively participated in drawing up the Napoleonic Code, a complete codification of the civil law. He initiated in 1801 a concordat with Pope Pius VII, which reestablished Roman Catholicism in France. Bonaparte also consolidated the national debt, restored the value of the French bonds, balanced the budget, established the Bank of France, and centralized equitable tax collection. Eventually, Napoleon ended the facade of the consulate, and December 2nd, 1804, he had himself crowned as Emperor Napoleon I in a ceremony presided over by Pope Pius VII. The concordat with the Church not only gave Napoleon the support of the Catholic clergy and their congregation, it also deprived the royalists of their chief argument for restoring the ancient regime, as religion under Napoleon was now restored to its former place. Time doesn't allow to go through all of the battles and all of the of his victories. He was the most brilliant general. After the victory that he had in the Battle of Austerlitz, which he defeated the joint Austro-Russian army commanded by Marshal Mikhail Kutuzov, and he forced them to sign what is known as the Treaty of Pressburg, he came back to France. And as we say, he says that he made his way through Alsace. Now, during this period, although the economic situation of the Jews of Alsace-Lorraine remained, which were the Ashkenazic Jews lived, from the whole the same, with most Jews still making a living through either peddling or selling secondhand clothing or lending money to non-Jews on interest, just as they had done before the revolution, there arose, however, a growing minority of Jews who made virtual fortunes equipping and supplying the troops of the various French armies. By the calculation of one historian, the heads of a quarter of all Jewish households in Alsace were engaged in some capacity of supplying the French army, soon some becoming fabulously wealthy. On the whole, however, lending on interest to the French peasantry of Alsace remained a mainstay of the Jewish economy, continuing to cause terrible ill will with the local populace. Now, after a stunning victory over the combined armies of Austria and Russia in Austerlitz, on December 2nd of 1805, Napoleon returned to Paris via Alsace. Stopping in Strasbourg, Napoleon was bombarded by the city's leaders with ceaseless complaints against the Jews. The issue of usury high interest was on the top of the list, as well as the refusal of the Jews of Alsace to assimilate and abandon their ancient religious customs. The fact is that through these chaotic years of unstable French governments, the self-government of the Jewish community under the Ashkenazic rabbinate remained a firm anchor for most of its members, all the whole ensuring, however, that the Jews continued to remain a quote-unquote nation within a nation. This gave further credence, however, to the claim of their enemies, that the Jews were simply not patriotic and were therefore unworthy of being granted civic equality. As a consequence, the Gentile leaders of Alsace and Lorraine requested Napoleon impose new laws to control and assimilate the Jews. Subsequently, after a fierce debate amongst his own council of state, whether to curtail the rights of the Jews or not, Napoleon issued a decree on May 30th, 1806, to convene an assembly of Jewish notables to correct what Napoleon views as an untenable situation, and similar to what he had done to the French Protestants, place the Jewish community and the Jewish religion under the auspices of the French government. All in all, 110 Jewish notables elected by the prefix of the various departments of France and Germany and Italian provinces that recently come under French rule met together on July 26, 1806 in Hotel de Ville in Paris with Abraham Furtado, an acculturated Jewish leader of the Sephardic community of Bordeaux, being elected presiding officer. By the way, it was Abraham Furtado, in describing the differences of opinion that were held within this assembly, who was the first who coined the term Orthodox as referring to Jews. This was used in reference to the Ashkenazic Jews of Alsace-Lorraine, who refused to compromise their beliefs and traditional values in order to be accepted by Napoleon and his government. Up until then, the term Orthodoxy was used solely in reference to Christian doctrine regarding the nature of Yeshu and the Trinity. The word Orthodox means correct opinion. The rabbinic leader and most respected and influential member of the assembly was the Rabbi Goyim Rav David Zinsheim, chief rabbi of Strasbourg and author of the Sefer Yad David, who together with other rabbis of Alsace-Lorraine used his influence to minimize any compromise that was contemplated by the so-called notables, who on the whole were quite assimilated. In the second meeting of the assembly, Napoleon submitted to the assembly the following 12 questions here on page 8. These are the questions submitted by Napoleon. Are Jews allowed to marry several wives? Does the Jewish faith permit divorce? And is an ecclesiastical divorce valid without the sanction of a civil court or valid in the face of the French code? May a Jewish marry a Christian or a Christian woman a Jew? Or does the Jewish law demand alliances between Jews only? Are the French in the eyes of the Jews their brethren or their enemies? In either case, what duties does the law prescribe for the Jews towards the French who are not of their faith? Do those Jews who are born in France and who are treated as French citizens regard France as their native country? And do they feel themselves obligated to defend it, to obey its laws, and to submit to all regulations of the civil code? Who appoints the rabbis? What police jurisdictions have the rabbis over the Jews, and what judicial authority do they possess? Does their prestige rest simply upon usage? Are there trades which law forbids the Jews to practice? Does the Jewish law interdict usury, the practice of usury, with their co-religionists? And does it prohibit or allow usurious practice with Gentiles? Those were the questions. Because time doesn't allow, we can read this, the responses. However, it says, pleased with the responses of the notables, Napoleon then decided to add dramatic flourish to his plan to reform the Jewish community and convened a so-called Sanhedrin, an assembly of 70 rabbinic leaders, superficially similar to the ancient assembly of rabbinic scholars at the time of the Beis HaMikdash, the temple, with their final stamp of approval upon the responses of this assembly of notables. Here where you can look is on page 8 in paragraph B, we have the public announcement, which was issued in Hebrew, French, Italian, German, to encourage the various regions of Napoleon's empire to send rabbinic delegates to the so-called Sanhedrin. On page 9, we have the official, we quote from the official declaration of the Sanhedrin. Basically, it is, they start, we declare the divine law, the precious heritage of our ancestors, contains religious as well as civil demands, that by their nature, religious demands are absolutely independent of circumstance and time. So they said that basically is that they are not, you notice that they clearly stated there's no room for compromise in areas which are clearly mandated by the halacha Jewish law. Regarding the Jewish community's interaction with the government and French society, some minor concessions were made. This is in an ambiguous language in order to maintain their continued independence. This is in their religious sphere. However, that which is based on religious tradition, says they are not compromising, but they're saying obeying the civil law is part of our religious tradition. If you note on here on page on that section before we deal with marriage, in that paragraph it says, therefore, in virtue of the right conferred upon us by our customs and our sacred laws, which determine that there resides in the assemblage of the learned men of the time the essential capacity to determine, in accordance with the needs of the cases, that which is required by the above mentioned laws, be they written or oral, we now proceed to declare that obeisance to the law of the state in matters civil and political is religiously required. So that's really how they dealt with them. In terms of marriage, however, which was very sensitive. You notice the bottom here before the third paragraph of marriage, before the military service. The Grand Sanhedrin declares further that marriage between Jews and Christians, which have been contracted in accordance with the laws of the civil code, are civilly legal. And that, although they may not be capable of receiving religious sanction, they should not be subject to religious proscription. Now, they wrote this in a very tactful manner. They're speaking but after the fact. And basically, it would seem, dealing with after the fact, it's a fact. And the Besdin, since no longer can issue, has been deprived of the power of enforcement and to issue charomim, nidui, any bans, well, we can't prescribe this. This was really, you can read the rest of the notes. As you'll notice, it was really done under tremendous duress, but with tremendous wisdom. And it was headed, of course, by this Reb David Zinsheim, who had been up until then, the chief rabbi of Strasbourg in Alsace. As a result of the conclusions of both the Assembly of Notables and the Sanhedrin, Napoleon was now ready to formulate his Jewish policy. On March 17, 1808, Napoleon issued three decrees affecting the Jewish community. One, the Jewish religion, like the Protestant religion, would be organized into a series of administrative entities called consistories. The consistories would be responsible for training, appointing rabbis, and granting them their salaries. Unlike the Christian clergy, the government itself would not pay their salaries, but rather it became the responsibility of the Jewish community. They were also given a mandate to ensure that within 10 years, every rabbi under their auspices would be fluent in French. You have to realize the native language of the Jews, the Ashkenazic Jews, was Judendeutsch, was Yiddish. The consistories were also given the responsibility of teaching the Jews patriotism and useful trades. The second decree was to declare many classes of debts null and void. This was to pacify the peasants of Alsace and also to force the Jews out of money lending into other forms of employment. You can only imagine the hardships this imposed. So, in other words, the debts were considered null and void. So all the money, their hard-earned, their life savings that they had put into this was now taken away. You can only imagine, says the hardship this imposed, of thousands of honest people now became bankrupt, having lent out their savings, and now were without hope of ever seeing their money returned. In addition, Napoleon imposed an additional burden by requiring any Jew entering business to pay for a special license. This was a financial hardship that was not imposed upon any other sector of French society. The third decree was that the Jews were not allowed to hire a replacement for themselves to serve in the military, a common practice amongst those French Gentiles who could afford it. These decrees, some of them onerous, were to be subject to review after 10 years. The hope was that after that the Jews would be so assimilated and so unrecognizable in French society, there would be no further need to discriminate against them. The truth is that at the end of 10 years, when Napoleon had already fallen from power, and Louis XVIII, this was Louis XVI's brother, was on the throne of France, those discriminatory laws were not renewed. Evidently, they had done their job. In July of that year, another decree was issued. The Jews were given 3 months to register with the authorities an official family name as well as a first name. To make sure that the last names didn't sound too identifiably Jewish, it was forbidden for them to choose a family name from the Bible or from the name of the town in which the person lived, such as the villages and hamlets of Alsace, where only Jews lived. The bright spot in all of this was that the person who was chosen to head the chief consistory of Paris was the former chief rabbi of Strasbourg, Harav HaGaon of Dovah Zinzan. And you can look at the notes here. This is the end of the last page, on page 10. He describes the difficulties he had. He's in Paris. He was without any sforim, without any books, and he was still able to, the necessary sforim, but any free moment that he had, he spent learning. When he passed away in 1813, this is the Chassam Sofer, one of the leading Rabbonim in Europe, eulogized him you can read this, in the greatest terms, as his tremendous goyness, his scholarship, his tzidkus, his saintliness. And the fact is, he was in a terribly difficult position, and he was able to, and he managed to handle it well. In addition to Zinzheim, who was the head of the main consistory, his son-in-law, Rav Avram Auerbach, a great scholar who also risked his life during the Reign of Terror to perform Bris Milah, the rite of circumcision, was appointed to head the consistory of the Rhine region. He serves as chief rabbi of Bonn for some 35 years. These great men, together with other dedicated rabbonim, tried to stem the tide of the assimilation of French Jewry. Now, the consistories remained orthodox in practice, although without yeshivas and with the secularization of society as a whole, French Jewry over time became less and less observant and less knowledgeable. We'll continue the story in the next lecture as we describe the changes that occurred within the Jewish community during the French occupation of Holland and Germany as the reform movement in Judaism began to take shape. Now, are there any questions?
I was looking here in the Declaration of Sanhedrin. One of the things it said that the Grand Sanhedrin declares that any Jew who is called to military service is, according to Jewish law, during the duration of the service, released from observing all religious obligations which interfere with such services. So is that the case? Is it normative halacha that... If you join the army, you don't have to keep Shabbos, keep kosher, stuff like that? Or am I reading too much into that?
Yeah, I think you're reading too much into that. The case is, just generally, once you're in the army, and if you don't keep Shabbos, you'll be shot and court-martialed. Well, you know, then you have no choice. Basically, they're saying that, on one hand, they're saying, well, if you force them and you'll kill them if they don't obey, then they're not required to keep the law. On the other hand, generally, what the Rabbonim have always tried to do is for those who really want to provide those services and to make things available for them, if at all possible. But it has always been a very difficult situation.
Yeah, because it seems like the military service would be an engine for assimilation.
Right, right. That's right. That's right. What? Yechiel of Paris was from the Bali Tosfos.
Right.
So he became the Rosh Yeshiva in Paris in the year 1124.
Right. So...
Was there any remnant from that time that had seeped into
the Jews already had been banned from France officially. There's at the end of the 1200s, and then and various things, they were thrown out, they were allowed back. By the mid 1300s, at the end of the 1300s, Jews were not allowed to be in France. And there were really no Jews there. What happened was that Sephardic Jews, Muranos, slipped in the western part of Bordeaux, Bayonne, so they slipped in. And they were practicing Catholics, but they were like Muranos, and they observed whatever they observed clandestinely. Eventually, they were allowed to practice. They were given freedom of religion, and because they were so assimilated, the French government general gave them all the rights of a French citizen.
When it was a society like that, if we had intellectuals like this, philosophers, they wouldn't have much of an effect on us. And yet it seems to have a huge effect on the German population. Mendelssohn, what was happening at the time that people would listen to them? These are philosophers that are over there.
They associated, it's, you're asking the question about what their pull on there was. It was a very similar thing to what happened to Jews in Russia and Poland in the mid to 1800s. The Jews were the subject of tremendous discrimination. They were not, those who, amongst the Jews who were wealthy, were those who already had common cause with the general population. So there's an association with the wealth and education that came with a better life. And they viewed, therefore, as those who were gebildet, those who were educated, were better people. And especially when it comes to German, in German, the culture, and at least the facade of being a more civilized and a better person. This is how they viewed, well, the Jews are uncouth. And it really, it had a tremendous pull for them, at least for many of them. Especially those who were no longer, you know, involved in the study of Torah. They were just out there in the business world. And they viewed this is great. And the other thing is backward.
Did it pull away a lot of Amon Am?
Yeah, it was pulling away. It was a process. But eventually, by the mid-1850s, the majority of German Jewry were no longer observant. So it was a long process. Okay, good to work.